From Oklahoma to South Carolina, Illinois to Oregon, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, immigration and action on the DACA program remain active issues before Congress, and there could be movement in the U.S. House in June. David and Sarah of the Heritage Foundation is here with details. Open congressional seats have provided an opportunity for pro-growth Republicans to improve their ranks. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story on whether or not that is happening. In a landmark case, the Supreme Court of the United States has given the green light to sports betting. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Michelle Minton of the Competitive Enterprise Institute about the ramifications. And in the Me Too era, the accused are often convicted in the court of public opinion before they get to a court of law. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, has an American Radio Journal commentary on the impact. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Immigration issues, including what to do with the over 700,000 so-called Dreamers, along with construction of the border wall and enhanced border enforcement, continue to be debated in Congress. But will there be any action? To find out, we talk with David and Sarah. David is a policy analyst with the Douglas and Sarah Ellison Center for Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation. David, welcome to American Radio Journal. David, immigration, of course, has been an ongoing, very big issue between Congress and the president. It affects millions of people around the country, enormous ramifications. All these issues continue to hang out there without resolution, but in the month of June, we may see some movement in the House. Tell us what's afoot.
So it appears as though there's going to be some action in June on some various immigration bills due to what's called a discharge petition. So basically there are usually things are brought to the floor, usually things are voted on because the leadership in the House brings bills, you know, they work their way out of committee and then the leadership puts them on the schedule and they're voted on. But this petition is a way for basically to go around leadership. And so essentially what's happened is you have some Republicans who are going to join with basically all the Democrats to vote on a discharge petition to have votes on various bills to provide amnesty to especially the people who are here illegally who were brought here as children, the so-called Dreamers, getting into the whole DACA fix. And so that's what these bills are all going to really be focused on.
As we look at these bills that are going to come before the House, David, obviously the House is only one component of it. Is there any similar movement in the Senate?
No. So the Senate has, as far as I know, they don't have a sort of similar process for this. So instead, I think this is primarily happening in the House. The House is going to have various immigration bills, some of which I think from what I've seen, some will just be pure. The Democrats will have their bill out there. And if it wins the vote, it will actually be the bill that emerged from the House. And so you could have a Republican House with the Republican majority and a Republican Speaker of the House actually vote out Democratic amnesty bills. And then those would proceed to the Senate, who may then take that up or not.
As we look at this, of course, DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, something that expired here a few months ago, it's something that there's been a lot of talk about action on. Is there any possibility that this bill might be pared down to deal just specifically with that group of, what, about 700,000 individuals?
Yeah, so that's exactly the numbers are fluctuating. So some folks, I think, would prefer that if you are going to be, you know, talking about giving people legal status, well, it's just focused on the 700,000. The other bills are saying, well, it's a broader group of people, 1.2, 1.8 million people. We don't really know where that number will end up. And that's sort of one of the problems, I think, that often happens in these amnesties is that you don't always know sort of what the amnesty you're giving away is, unless, for instance, it is limited to the people who are already in the program. Then you know exactly what that number is. But when you expand it to include broader criteria, you don't always know where that's going to end up. And I think it's also unfortunate because we talk about numbers we're giving amnesty to and who we're going to legalize and all that sort of stuff. But lost in this discussion is a discussion about other immigration reforms. The American people, I think, expect and want reforms to the legal immigration system, our enforcement, our border security, things that obviously, you know, President Trump ran on. And those things seem to get lost in the mix whenever we have these bills that are talking about legalizing people.
as that gets lost in the mix, what has been the past history as well when amnesty has been granted? It's been some decades now since that has occurred. Mm. But isn't the past experience that the amnesty is granted, but the reforms, the toughening up of border security enforcement, changes in the immigration program, those things tend to then never happen, don't they?
Yeah, the biggest example we have on this is the last big amnesty was 1986, and legalization of, you know, I think about 2.5 million folks. And I've read the Senate transcript. I've read what the senators were saying. They were all saying things like, this is a one-time thing. We're just going to do this one time, but it has to be done. And then we're going to have so much other enforcement stuff that this will be unthinkable. You know, this will never happen again. We're going to solve our problem. 30 years later, there wasn't enough done, and Congress consistently sort of said, we don't need to do more on border security. We don't need to do more on enforcement. And now we get to where we are today, where once again we're saying, well, we just need to do the amnesty, just fix this little problem, and then, yeah, sure, we'll make some little tweaks, and we'll get it done. But we'll get the enforcement done. We'll make sure this never happens again. But it's like, why don't we just actually make changes to our enforcement system? Why don't we make pro-growth changes to our legal immigration system that would better serve the American economy? Why don't we do those things first, because it would help all Americans? And then we can turn to the question of what do we do with the folks who are here illegally? It seems like Congress has their order reversed and they're not remembering their history.
In addition to that, as Congress debates and discusses this, of course, the White House and President Trump are major players. The president made a big campaign issue out of building a wall, out of toughening enforcement. Is there any action toward actually getting a wall built and toughening up enforcement along the southern border?
This is, I think, one of the areas exactly where I think we should be looking for action. Congress, I think there's been, you know, literally government shutdowns over DACA, but yet I think all conservatives in the administration want are, you know, proper, there's different ways to do it, but better border security, better enforcing of our laws. Those shouldn't be controversial issues, you know, border security and enforcing our laws, and yet those sort of issues are being held captive to, you have to give us amnesty, and then maybe we'll give you some of the things you want on border security and enforcement. And it just doesn't completely reverse. We should be talking about, let's have a legitimate conversation about what the best way to enforce our laws are. Let's talk about the cost-effective way to do border security. And then when those things are done, then we can have the more difficult conversation about what do we do with the people who are here illegally. But like I said, Congress has that order all reversed.
We have been talking with David and Sarah, who is a policy analyst at the Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign Policy, that at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. David, tell us a little bit about Heritage. Also, you've written extensively on this. Where can folks go to read those writings?
The Heritage Foundation, we're a think tank here in D.C., and we're dedicated to building an America where freedom, opportunity, prosperity, and civil society flourish. And you can find my writings and the writings of the rest of my colleagues at www.heritage.org.
David and Sarah of the Heritage Foundation. David, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thanks for having me.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth, keeping an eye on what has become a very active primary season around the country this year. Andy, good to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me, Loman.
Well, this past Tuesday, we had primaries, particularly in the Lone Star State, Texas. Andy, as we look at the primaries that are occurring, and let's talk about races for U.S. House of Representatives seats, obviously choosing who is going to represent the Republican Party going into the November election, the battle here is between establishment Republicans who tend to be Democrat light and conservative pro-growth Republicans. Are we making any progress toward moving the conference more toward a pro-growth point of view?
Definitely. Just to give some perspective, there's about 235 Republicans in the House, and most of them are running for re-election, and most of them who are running for re-election are going to win. But there are 40 seats, where the incumbent is retiring or running for Senate or running for governor or doing something. So you have these 40 seats where you have a competitive opening for a conservative to win. And we're already in late May, and we've had 18 of those 40 primaries already settled. And so what I'm interested in is looking at those 18 seats and seeing what has happened, and is the House Republican Conference getting more conservative Is it getting less conservative? What's happening? And so we found a couple of interesting things. Of the 18, three of them are likely going to the Democrats. So in that sense, the House Republican conference is ultimately going to get smaller, at least as of today. Maybe by November, things will improve. But of those 18, three are likely going to the Democrats. Then of the remaining 15 open Republican seats, eight of them, more than half, have been upgraded. And then another six, there's been no change in whether they've been upgraded or not. And let me make a point about how I determine whether it's been upgraded or downgraded, is what is the incumbent's score on the Club for Growth scorecard, and what do we anticipate the newcomer score is going to be on the Club for Growth scorecard. And so using that measuring stick, we believe that there are going to be eight upgrades, six no changes, and then only two downgrades. So the takeaway from all this is that the House Republican Conference is likely going to be smaller in number but more conservative. And I think overall that's probably a pretty good thing.
When you say the conference is going to be smaller, of course, the big overarching question here, Andy, is will Republicans remain in a majority? The generic ballot, which is somewhat of an indicator because all of these races are essentially local, but the generic ballot seems to be turning to Republicans' favor after having been heavily in favor of the Democrats earlier this year. So where do you see the overall trend going here? Is it possible Republicans can retain that majority?
Early June might give us a better indication of that. And the reason why is because the House Republican majority will be dictated by a handful of states: New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Illinois, and then California. Illinois already had its primaries. There was nothing surprising there. The Republicans are now going to go against the Democrats in the fall. We have not had primaries yet in New Jersey or New York, but they're coming up. Pennsylvania, obviously, we had redistricting there, and that's where we lost three of those 18 open primary seats. And I say that we are losing them, but we obviously won't know until November. But because of redistricting, things have gotten pretty bad there. So we lost three seats there. The reason why I mentioned early June is because California and New Jersey are going to have their primaries on June 5th. And California is interesting because they have open primaries where Republicans, Democrats, and other parties all compete on the same ballot. And the top two finishers in that primary advance to the runoff in November. And there may be some instances where two Republicans run against each other in November or two Democrats run against each other in November. So a lot of seats can be determined that way just by squeezing out the Republican from even advancing to the November race. So we're going to learn a lot over the next couple of weeks.
As we mentioned earlier, Texas had its primary this past week. In terms of upgrades, in terms of the nominee of the Republican Party becoming more pro-growth, things were moving in the right direction in Texas?
Yeah, that's one of the great successes so far this year, is that there were six open seats in Texas, and Republicans basically elected a conservative in all of them except one. And in that one exception, we just got outspent in the very expensive Dallas media market. And when I mentioned earlier that these seats got upgraded, here's one example. Lamar Smith represents Texas's 21st district. He is retiring. He got a 75% lifetime score on the Club for Growth scorecard. He will likely be replaced by Chip Roy, who is the former chief of staff to Ted Cruz. Chip will not only do better than 75% on our scorecard, he may very well get 100%. He's that good. And Lamar Smith, the man who's retiring, he was not a member of the House Freedom Caucus, but Chip Roy will likely be a member. So when we talk about upgrading a seat, this is definitely an upgrade. And there are a couple other examples in Texas where that happened in a very similar fashion. So Texas Republican voters are definitely sending a statement this year saying, we want more conservative members. We want to elect people who are going to follow and support Trump's pro-growth agenda, and we want that to happen now.
As we look forward to the June 5th primaries in New York and New Jersey, any particular districts we should pay close attention to?
Yeah, the open seats there are going to be like Ed Royce's seat in California 39, Daryl Issa in California 49. Unfortunately, though, California is just not hospitable for conservatives. So I don't know that there's anything for conservatives to be excited about in California, but there are still opportunities for Republicans.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, tell us a bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. As always, Andy, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Sports betting, previously illegal in most of the country, is now legal as a result of a recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling. To find out what happens next, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Michelle Minton of the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Americans bet more than $4 billion on this past year's Super Bowl, and almost all of it was bet illegally. But thanks to the U.S. Supreme Court, there's a chance that next year's Super Bowl could feature a much higher percentage of legal wagers. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Michelle Minton. She is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute here in Washington, D.C., and she joins us on the phone. She's an expert for CEI on sports betting, gambling, all sorts of various vice issues, and she joins us to talk about this big Supreme Court ruling from just about a week ago. Michelle, thanks for taking some time and being here.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me on.
So let's start with the basics here. The Supreme Court decision last Monday struck down part of a 1992 law known as the Bradley Act, named for Bill Bradley, the former NBA star who later became a U.S. senator from New Jersey. And the Bradley Act basically made sports betting illegal across the United States with a few exceptions. So let's start there. Take us back to 1992 and tell us what the Bradley Act did and then what this new Supreme Court ruling did to it.
Yeah, so back in 92, there were a bunch of states that were talking about legalizing sports betting, and this really worried people, some people in Congress, and particularly sports leagues. They were afraid that if there was legal sports betting, people would start to wonder if the games were fixed. And so instead of doing due diligence, educating players and the population about what the leagues were doing to prevent corruption, they just asked the federal government, hey, can you just ban this across the country? And so Nevada at the time already had sports betting. They couldn't really ban it wholesale across the nation, but what they did was say, hey, if you don't already have sports betting now, 1992, you can never do it again. And they wrote this law in a very particular way where they were clearly trying to get around the issue that the federal government cannot tell state legislators what to do. So they wrote it saying, so this law bans, it makes illegal sports betting pursuant to state law, aka if it's legal via state law, then it is illegal under federal law, which is just a tricky workaround to say states can't legalize sports betting, which nobody did up until around 2012. New Jersey has been just really angry about this law since 1992. They tried to enact sports betting right before the law went into effect, couldn't make it happen. In 2012, the voters said, we want sports betting legalized. They think it'll help Atlantic City, which has been having a hard time over the last couple decades. And so New Jersey tried to get around the law. They were sued every time by the leagues. In a previous court case, the Solicitor General said, look, it's not what we call commandeering. Federal government isn't telling New Jersey what to do. If they want to, they can just get rid of all their bans on sports betting, and then they can do it that way. So New Jersey said, okay, we'll do that. And then they did that, and the league said, wait, we're suing you again. That's just legalization by any other name. You can't just eliminate your prohibition. And that's why it went up to the Supreme Court.
This ruling has some important implications for federalism, obviously in a pretty general sense. I mean, it's a big win for people who like the idea that states should be allowed to write their own rules and not get bullied by the federal government. But more specifically on the issue of sports betting, it's not just New Jersey. It looks like maybe also Delaware, Pennsylvania, West Virginia. There's a few other states that have already geared up to legalize or in some cases actually passed bills already in anticipation of the outcome of this Supreme Court case. So legalization of sports betting is coming, and it's coming pretty quick.
Sometime in June, some of the states are aiming to have sports gambling online. Well, not online, but they're ready to have it to go, offering it to consumers. The online question is a little bit trickier, whether they can do that, and I think that will probably generate its own court cases once New Jersey tries to put sports betting online. We'll see how that goes. But, yeah, there's six states that have already passed legislation in anticipation of this court ruling, and they're going to be ready to go very quickly.
We're talking with Michelle Minton. She's a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute and the author of a report on legalizing sports betting in the United States. You can find that at CEI.org. Michelle, I want to talk a little bit about the league's reaction to this decision, because you said earlier it was the sports leagues themselves that had been suing New Jersey for all these years as the state was trying to legalize. But now you've got some of the leagues actually coming out and saying that they're in favor of this decision. They're in favor of legalization. What's driving that change? What's driving the shift in the way the sports leagues are looking at this, and how the leagues are getting involved in the policymaking process?
Yeah, there are a couple leagues and some people within the league organizations who've been saying for a little while that they think it should be legalized, because even though it was prohibited, it didn't stop Americans from spending billions and billions of dollars every year doing it anyway in the black market. And what really changed is when the court decision came down. And so the league's opinions have been changing, but they were all still party to the lawsuits against New Jersey. They're still costing the taxpayers in New Jersey untold numbers of dollars to fight this court case. But now that now that sports gambling is here, the leagues have started to lobby state governments to say, hey, you know, when you put your regulations in, can you just add a little percentage on top of it for us? You know, just transfer some of that money directly to us that people are betting on our games with. It's kind of hilarious, especially when you look at New Jersey. What I've been saying is, if you're going to give them this so-called integrity fee, they're saying it's going to cost them money to deal with corruption now because it's legalized. I think the league should pay back the state of New Jersey every penny that they cost them, taking them to court all these many years. But I don't think they should get an integrity fee at all, because if anything, legalizing sports betting makes it easier for them to track corruption and deal with it.
Sure. And if you bring it out of the shadows, sports betting, it's been legal in Europe for a long time, and the soccer leagues over there, they're able to track all of the bets that are made, and then they know in advance whether a game is maybe fixed or if a referee has possibly been paid off, something like that.
The bookies, even back in the day, the 1919, the Black Sox scandal, the World Series of Baseball, the bookies knew before the first pitch was ever thrown that the game was fixed just by looking at the way people were betting. It made no sense. People were betting on the underdog, and there was no explanation for it. You know, lots and lots of money on the underdog. They were like, something fishy here. The game's probably fixed. They knew it.
Yeah, and like so many other things, you know, once you bring it out of the shadows, you bring it out into the open, it's easier to monitor that and prevent those things. This is why prohibition doesn't work. As we said at the very top here, you know, Americans literally spend billions of dollars on sports betting every year, and that's going to happen whether this is legal or not. So I think better for it to be done legally. That is, unfortunately, though, all the time that we have for today. Michelle Minton, thanks for taking some time and joining us here on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
And again, that is Michelle Minton. She is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and you can check out her report. It's titled Legalizing Sports Betting in the United States. It's a great roundup of the whole history of sports betting in the U.S. and then a look ahead to what comes next now that the Supreme Court has repealed part of the Bradley Act and opened it up to allow states to do what they please on this issue. Again, you can find her report at CEI.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Thanks for joining us, folks. We'll catch you right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The concept of innocent until proven guilty is at the bedrock of our nation's judicial system, but trial by media frequently takes its place. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, discusses on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Absolutely no one should make light of an accusation of sexual harassment or abuse. By the same token, our entire nation is built on a judicial system in which you are innocent until proven guilty. The presumption of innocence is a centerpiece of our judicial system. The court of public opinion, though, takes on an entirely different mantra in which significant damage is done to a person's personal reputation before they have gone to trial. The Me Too movement justifiably exposed the embarrassing secrets in Hollywood in which countless victims were abused because of the power of a few. The moment the presumption of innocence is lost, however, tremendous damage is done to innocent victims who are on the sidelines of the horror being played out in society. If you believe that the American judicial system is about justice, you are so wrong. It is about winning. One need only look at our history to see the dangers of a judicial system run amok. In 1857, in the Dred Scott decision, the United States Supreme Court ruled that no slave could become a U.S. citizen. It's reasonable to assume that the Scott decision was over 150 years ago and not reflective of today's courts. Unfortunately, miscarriages of justice are all too common in our legal system today, and especially in the court of public opinion. Recently, I was approached by some individuals who were falsely accused, acquitted, and then the records were expunged by judges who felt that there was a miscarriage of justice. Unfortunately, in internet search engines, many of these stories still exist, which follow the innocent person for the rest of their lives. Fixing such injustice is virtually impossible. Thus, the innocent are guilty in the court of public opinion, and all the while, the accuser is untouched. It's important to note that there can be an expungement, however, for other than miscarriages of justice, but in the cases I examine, it was a miscarriage of justice that was the case. The reality of the legal system is that it is just too complex, costly, procedural, and justice is frequently lost in the process. Even judges and attorneys are frustrated by the system that has evolved. There is a horrible dichotomy in the justice system today. Those individuals and companies with great wealth can easily run roughshod on those less fortunate. At the same time, those with no financial resources can easily run up the cost on others to such a point that settlements on no merit cases are agreed to in order to avoid legal costs. Unfortunately, the persons lost in this great struggle are the vast majority of middle-class families merely trying to get by. To fix this system requires a complete overhaul of our courts and our laws. To begin with, attorneys should be held to a higher standard and held accountable for filing frivolous suits. The names of those accused, especially minors, must be protected until at least an indictment is issued or a court sanctions releasing the accused's name. Virtually every state has disciplinary boards for attorney or judicial misconduct. The remedies are significant and will help clean up the profession. Most attorneys and judges are tremendous defenders of the Constitution and your rights, but some are not. An advocacy function needs to be established for the courts in which procedural delays can be addressed by other than the defendant or the plaintiff. To require cases to move along by someone associated with the courts reduces cost and forces resolution of cases. Public defender funding has to increase in order to provide for the best defense for those in poverty. The tremendous cost associated with the current system almost precludes justice from being rendered. Just as no American should go bankrupt from medical expenses, neither should Americans go bankrupt defending themselves from a system out of control. We must also stop criminalizing all behavior. Legislators should focus on repealing laws and stop criminalizing behavior, which can best be dealt with in more effective ways. Reforming the court of public opinion is another much more complicated matter where even greater damage can be done to the innocent person. Sentences can be meted out even before trials are held. Until false accusations are dealt with criminally, the court of public opinion will run amok. In the case of the Me Too movement, it makes no sense to punish the masses for the sins of a few. It also makes no sense to create more victims in order to merely strike back. Punish only those who committed the act. Just as sexual abuse is disgraceful, so is vengeance. Justice should be blind. Justice must be fair. The judicial system must be reformed if we are to remain a great society. The beacon of light of our Statue of Liberty and the lives of those brave Americans who died defending our Constitution demand no less. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country. They include WENG AM and FM in Englewood, Florida, WQSU-FM in Selins Grove, Pennsylvania, along with WBBC-FM and WKLV-AM in Blackstone, Virginia. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.